Hello, everyone. I'm Molly Wood.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Welcome to Make Me Smart. We are joined, as always, by you, because none of us, as we like to say, is as smart as all of us.
This week, let's see, I think Kai has been in at least 9 cities.
Oh, yeah.
I've only been in a paltry 3.
Wow.
I'm coming to you live from New Orleans at this moment.
You get all the fun jobs, man.
I mean, I'm going to try to make it sound not very fun. Oh, I have a terrible cold. I'm getting such a cold.
Are you really?
Oh. Well, yeah, because I've been in 9 cities this week. Yeah. Apparently, that doesn't have these things don't happen to Kai Rizdahl, but I am as fragile as a flower.
Yeah, I'm young and strong of heart. But anywho,
So coming up on the show today, we have Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella, who had a big announcement this week about Microsoft's education plans, and I'm excited about this. This is his first ever podcast appearance.
Oh wow, that's cool.
He's never done a podcast before.
I'm not sure I knew that. That's awesome. Also, on this particular installment of Make Me Smart, Stan Collender, the budget guy, on the line to explain 5 budget terms in normal human language because the federal government is working on a budget. And you guys in our Facebook Live this week said, listen, help us understand this. And I said, okay, here we go.
It's basically like this week what happened is we went off and we did our own thing and we brought back presents for the podcast.
That's exactly right, which is, I think, somewhere in the pilot process what we thought we were going to do.
I know. It's all working. It's all coming together. So today, I know that most of you will not be listening to this episode today, but today slash this week, Microsoft announced a sort of a fairly substantial move into education. It's really a move around shoring up the castle walls in the education market, because Microsoft does still dominate ed tech in terms of sales, but that pesky little Chromebook situation is starting to get pretty serious.
Yeah.
So Microsoft held a big event where they announced a whole new version of Windows, actually, pretty significantly, aimed at the education market, a brand new laptop. Some of its partner companies, I think Asus and a couple others, are going to make inexpensive sort of Chromebook competitors. And they talked about other sort of software initiatives that bring together all the parts of Microsoft, like Minecraft, which they own.
Really? Man, you'd have thought I'd have known that.
Yeah. I can tell you, my child was worried.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Somehow, even at 9, the tender age of 9, he was like, are they going to ruin it? And I said, well, you do have your finger on the pulse of Microsoft, but so far they haven't screwed it up. Anyway, pretty big initiative, pretty big attempt to, you know, keep Google away from the gates and, you know, start marketing early to kindergartners.
Hey, man.
But before, now I made it sound all mercenary, so this is a good time to say that before we jump into the full interview... Since everything in life is a little bit of both, we want to play this one bit of tape from Satya Nadella in which he talks about why this education push is so important to him personally.
I would say education for me, both because of my own story and then now with my kids here, has significantly influenced how I think about it. You know, my entire life is being shaped perhaps because of the educational outcomes and decisions that my great-grandmother made. My great-grandmother was growing up in a village, and she was widowed young. This is in a southern part of India. And she moved to the nearest town and made one crucial decision that has pretty much shaped the family history. So she had 2 sons. One of them was the more sort of trustworthy, and the other one was more getting into trouble. And so she decided to send the one who was more getting into trouble to school and the trustworthy to day labor. And the kid, obviously, who went to school went on to get into the Indian Police Service, and his son, my father, went on to college, and then rest is history. And then the family that was the more trustworthy son who went on to do day labor, ultimately his grandchildren have gotten to college. But that economic distinction and difference has shaped our personal histories. And that sort of speaks to me. I mean, that's why I think education can really make a massive difference.
Yeah.
I would say modern world in the last 200 years or 150 years has mostly been because of the educational opportunities that have then led to economic opportunities for all of us.
It's a good story. It's a good story about
it is a good story.
Great grandfathers or whatever they were. Holy cow, man.
I didn't find out what happened to the other brother, though. I kind of want to, I mean, you know, clearly his grandchildren are not the CEO of Microsoft.
Right.
But yeah, it was a good story.
Yeah.
It was a good story. All right. We're going to get into the first part of our interview with him right now.
we've been in the education market for ever since the inception of Microsoft. If you think about Microsoft's own origin, the first product was basically a development tool for hobbyists. So to us, when we think about our mission of empowering every person and every organization on the planet to achieve more, there is no better place to start that empowerment than enhancing the learning moments of students. Any economy is only thriving if it is able to take the benefits of education and translate it into economic surplus and growth. So therefore, to us, doing some of our best work, not just for Microsoft, but anyone in tech, to do their best work in education is only going to grow the economy to a point where we can participate in that broader opportunity.
How big of a market is this for you?
Education by itself, in relative terms, is a small market for us, but its second-order effects are huge because in some sense, all students graduate and eventually go to colleges and then get to the workforce. And so what you learn and what you're familiar with in schools will have an ultimate impact in terms of what they will choose at their workplace. But beyond that, we are a worldwide leader when it comes to today as educational infrastructure. Windows has got market share leadership there. And so it's an important business. We don't break it down by segment. But it's not, I don't think of education just as a return on investment just on its own, but I think about it the broader impact.
Who do you see as your primary competitor?
I would say, you know, primarily in education, Google and Apple. Apple and Microsoft have competed, you know, since our inception on some of these markets. But I actually think that, you know, all three of us perhaps pushing each other to do our best work here is probably the best thing that's happening in education. I don't think that the competition by itself is the important story here. Of course, it's a reality, and it's more competitive market than it ever has been. And the people who benefit from that should be the schools, the students, the teachers, the administrators.
How are you determining outcomes? You know, how are you looking at what students should learn?
That's a great question.
And how?
First of all, one thing that I'm very grounded on is sometimes in technology and technology companies, we sort of think about our technology is the answer. And I am not a believer in that. Ultimately, technology can be a tool. So how are we going to measure it? It's going to be the measurements of the school systems. It's real. Like when someone says the educational outcome of digital ink, the ability for someone to retain their learning is 30% more. That's not a study we do. It has to be a study that is, in fact, peer-reviewed and published by the people in the educational field. So if we can sort of put those tools in the hands of the teachers and students, and then the measurements come from them.
Do you worry that these tools might get into those hands and then end up, you know, feeding test scores? I mean, do you think I'm designing this thing so that kids can have this amazing augmented reality experience and an individualized moment and be inspired? How concerned are you with what happens when it gets into the classroom and whether that occurs?
I mean, it's one thing that you're bringing up, which is a very, very key element, is not to create a new digital divide because of technology being unevenly spread. And so that's sort of, I think, a huge element in the United States and world over. And that's why we want to bring the cost of these devices. We want to build these kits where the parts in it are all less than a dollar, so that if you want to build something, you can in fact do it. Whether it's in Kenya or in East Palo Alto, you can have access to these kids. That's, I think, another huge responsibility all of us have in this industry, so that you don't create what you just said, which is, I think you're absolutely right. If all it turns out is the people who are already advantaged get more of an advantage because of digital technology, that will not be the outcome that any of us desire in any society.
So I arguably have a fairly advantaged public school, but it's still a public school in Oakland. And when I hear about these tools, I think that would be amazing. I have no idea how those would get into, like, what are the mechanics of this stuff actually arriving in, you know, an Oakland public school? Because it is easy to imagine a universe where they just show up in charter schools, or they just show up in private schools, or my school just doesn't have its act together because our parent volunteers work a lot.
No, actually,
you know, is that something that you worry about when you roll out products?
We do
like
worry about that, but we do spend a lot of time and energy in making sure, for example, with the large public school systems, that we work with them in their procurement. The other places we have to remove friction. Something like Office 365, for example, is all free. So we've also made it approachable, accessible to a public school system so that we do not have economic barriers that get in the way of adoption. So we come at it on all sides of it.
I'm surprised in preparing for this. I was surprised at the lack of definitive research about how technology works in schools. There are studies on both sides. There are some that say a one-to-one laptop scenario improves student learning. And then there was a big MIT study at West Point that said classrooms that had no technology, where technology was banned, had 18 points higher test scores. Are you looking at any of that?
Yeah, absolutely. Because I think that's the mistake, which is if you sort of take technology on its own and think that that's going to lead to the outcome and ignore the dedication of a teacher or the motivation of the student or the involvement of the family or even the enlightened administrator. Because that magic happens when all of those constituents come together and then there is technology that they can use. Getting that right is the art form. And at least that's what we have learned. Mm-hmm. And, in fact, there was a Microsoft researcher who spent a bunch of time in India chasing after, saying, here is technology and it's in school. Is it making a difference? And the conclusion he came to was that technology can at best be a tool and it really comes down to the people involved.
Fascinating. So I have a question.
Yeah.
And it goes like this, and you sort of asked him this question, this, and he kind of danced around it. It's about getting these things in schools, and I'll tell you why I asked, mm-hmm. right? There's a first-mover advantage here that I think Microsoft has missed, much as they missed with the phone, right? Because kids in my, granted, extremely privileged local public school, they already have Chromebooks.
Yep.
You know?
Mine, too.
Yeah. And mm-hmm. honestly, my now seventh grader, he's had it for a couple of years, he loves his Chromebook, and the idea of getting him to switch, let alone getting the whole system to switch.
Yep.
It is just a non-starter.
It's really funny. I think, and I've gone back and forth about this with both the Microsoft, the PR people that I've been working with and myself. I want to get their salesperson on the line.
Right, right. Give me the pitch, yo.
Right. And I want to, because I am exactly with you and I'm weirdly obsessed with, all right, how are you going to come to my school or Kai's school and say, these Chromebooks, they just can't do what you need. You should reinvest, because I'll tell you, schools, one thing they don't do is reinvest,
right? Exactly. Exactly. And it was a huge hurdle to get the whole Chromebooks thing going in my school system. And
well, and I've been to the parent-teacher, ours is like called the PFC, the Parent-Faculty Club meeting, where we try to make spending decisions, God help me.
Yeah.
Which is why I only work on the auction and won't join the parent board, because it's like a nightmare.
Totally.
It's a nightmare. Totally. So anyway, yes, I'm way too close to that, as are you. But I have the exact same question, so I think clearly we need to talk to the sales guy.
Yeah, totally. All right. Speaking of spending decisions, let us talk for just a moment about the federal budget. Next up, Stan Collender, the budget guy, on the line to explain the budget terms you need to know as Congress decides how they are going to spend our money.
And after that, because I know we all have 10 to 100 follow-up questions for Satya and Nadella, not up to and including student privacy, there will be a little bit more from that interview as well.
All right, so yesterday in our Facebook Live video, which is a thing we do every Monday at noon-ish Pacific time, we try to be really prompt, and it's sort of like the setup for the week and what's on our minds and what we're going to talk about and what you guys want us to talk about. Anyway, that's what happened yesterday. Heidi Bramblett expressed what seemed like a perfectly reasonable and doable thing. She said, quote, "I would really like to hear the plain English version of the congressional budget and why it didn't matter when we didn't have one, that is to say a budget. Is that possible?"
And it turns out that it is, and Kai knows a guy.
I got a guy. I know a guy who knows a guy.
The guy. Kai's got a guy for this. Stan Collender, a.k.a. the budget guy, who, I mean, really, if you're going to have a guy, he better be the budget guy, which is his actual Twitter handle. And at something like 5:30 a.m. this morning, Kai said, we should just call this guy up. He's the author of the Guide to the Federal Budget, and he could do the job.
So we asked him to explain, as you will hear in regular, plain old layman's English, five things about the federal budget that are very jargony, but people need to know. And here you go. Mm-hmm. Stan Collender, good to talk to you again.
Great to be here. What's going on?
Well, the budget's going on, Stan, as you know, which is why we've called you. Great hue and cry from the masses out there for English language explanations of what's going on with this budget and how it's all going to work. So I'm going to throw some words at you, and you're going to tell me what they mean. Does that make sense?
I'll do my best. It's not going to be easy.
The first one with this budget and with most budgets the past couple of years has been this word, sequester. What does that mean?
Well, it's actually pretty simple. The Congress and the President agreed to spending caps, limits on the amount you can spend on security, that's basically military, and domestic spending, which is everything that isn't military. So there are individual caps, and if Congress and the President manage to sign legislation, enact legislation that would spend more than the caps, then you have a sequester. There are a variety of ways of doing it over the years, but essentially it would take spending back to the agreed-upon levels to the caps in each category. And it's supposed to be automatic across the board, implemented by the Office of Management and Budget, and not stoppable.
So it's like a dead man switch. You spend too much money, we take money away.
Exactly right. Whether you want to call it a dead man switch or a guillotine,
yeah.
The bottom line is that Congress and the President are not supposed to be able to spend more than the limits that they've already set in law for themselves.
And it's still in effect from, what, I guess 2011? Is that when it was done?
Well, and it was extended by an extra year. So
okay.
there are spending caps all the way through 2023. So unless Congress and the President decide to change them, which they're on the verge of doing for this year, then the sequester is in place and the threat of these across-the-board cuts goes into account.
Okay, here's another one, and it's got some very specific meanings when it comes to budget. Reconciliation.
Reconciliation. This is not the same term you use in marital problems. reconciliation, when you're talking about the federal budget, is when the budget that Congress passes assumes certain changes in law. It could be ups or downs or you know, increases, decreases in taxes or spending. And through reconciliation, they reconcile permanent law with the assumptions they made about individual tax provisions or spending programs. What's important about reconciliation isn't just that it forces Congress to make the changes that they assumed in the budget, again, just for mandatory spending or for taxes, but it prevents a filibuster in the Senate.
Mm.
And that's why it's such a powerful tool, because there are a few things in life that prevent the Senate from filibustering if they want to, and this is one of them.
Revenue neutral. Is that as easy as it sounds?
It actually means that you're not going to pass legislation that either increases or decreases revenues, that's total revenues, into the federal government compared to what it would be under current law. So, for example, in 1986, when the last Comprehensive Tax Reform Act passed, the discussions from the beginning were that the bill had to be revenue neutral so that it wouldn't increase taxes and therefore increase the tax burden overall on the country,
mm-hmm.
or decrease taxes and therefore increase the deficit.
Okay. Speaking of deficit, debt versus deficit, and which one is more important when you're talking about the federal budget?
This is the most confusing concept or series of concepts that exist in federal budgeting. It's a thing that I would say many members, maybe even most members of Congress, get wrong. The deficit is the annual difference between the amount you take in revenue and the amount you spend. The debt is all the accumulated deficits of the previous years, plus interest, that you haven't yet paid off.
Is there one that's more important than the other?
Well, it depends. Obviously, the debt is important because you want to have an economy that's capable of handling both the interest payments that you have to make on the debt and the total debt burden, because the government's going to be borrowing a lot of money to pay for it every year. The deficit is important both for political and economic terms, depending upon the economy that year. I mean, we've got an economy at the moment that's growing relatively tepidly at 2 or 3%. But do you really want to have the government run a deficit and spend more or tax less and therefore heat up the economy even further? So they're both important, but they're both important for different reasons.
Okay, last one, and I guess it's the end game of this whole thing if negotiations go down the toilet. Government shutdown, what does that exactly mean?
Well, essentially, it means what it says. The Constitution requires that no money shall be spent except that's been appropriated. And if the government shuts down, it means the appropriations have lapsed for some programs. And that's exactly what could happen, as you get close to the fiscal year beginning on October 1st. if Congress and the President haven't agreed on the 12 annual appropriations or on a continuing resolution, which would allow the government to continue operating, then those programs dependent on a on an appropriation simply stop operating. It means that you can't get into a national park because you can't pay the rangers and because the grass isn't allowed to grow. Now, the one thing is that over the years, we've done a variety of things. The government has done a variety of things. That mitigates this a little bit. Programs that are considered essential for one reason or another can continue even in the absence of appropriation. And that's everything from defense, which you obviously don't shut the Defense Department down, and you don't tell the soldiers who are might be in battle to stop fighting. But it's everything from defense to the zookeepers at the National Zoo who feed the animals, because if they didn't feed the animals, then the animals would die. So there are a variety of things that can be considered essential, even if in the absence of an appropriation and therefore a shutdown.
I'm going to take one more and exercise host's privilege here, just because it's going to come up as the budget deal that's being worked on right now expires come the end of September. Debt limit and how it factors into all of this stuff.
Well, the government has the equivalent of what everybody else has on a MasterCard or Visa. That is a limit on the amount it can borrow. This goes back to 1917 with the World War One. The government needed to borrow frequently, and so Congress said, instead of us having to approve each individual debt issuance, we're just going to give you a credit limit, and that's the debt ceiling. You can borrow up to that, and whenever you pay down some of the debt, you can borrow up to it again, but you can't borrow more. And right now we've reached the debt ceiling, but because the government can do the equivalent of getting a cash advance on its Visa card to make a payment on its MasterCard, It can go till about September. But once you get to September, the government's literally going to run out of cash because it's running a deficit. And if it doesn't fix the borrowing limit, then it won't have enough money to make good on its bills. And it could default on contractual payments and a variety of other things like that. So that's really one of the most difficult bills to pass every year, because members of Congress think it stops spending from happening if they don't vote for it. That's not the case, but it becomes a political football every year.
Right. Stan Collender is Marketplace's go-to budget guy. He tweets at the budget guy. He is now at Corvus Communications. Stan, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
So if you have other stuff you want to know about the federal budget, but mostly about anything, email us, makemesmart@marketplace.org, and we will pursue it and figure out if it makes sense for us to do it.
Yeah, I mean, I hope if you've learned anything from that amazing explanation, it's that when you ask us questions, we go out and find the answers, which is the whole point of this show. And that was awesome. That guy is good.
Yeah.
All right, next up, more from Satya Nadella. But before that, we have got to pay the bills.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
I'm loving the like bayou sound
like
that Jenny has put into the show today.
Now, was that a banjo or a ukulele? Do we know?
It says it's called Mr. Uke himself, so I'm going to go with ukulele.
Read the rundown, Kat.
On that one. If I had to guess, I would say that this highlighted yellow field.
Fine. Call me out. B. be that way.
I feel like you guys are getting all the sausage making today. We're talking about, you know, what happened in the pilot process, how we got the budget guy, what our rundown looks like. We're all about transparency.
That is true.
All right. More from Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella on the question that I actually think is the most important, which is how are you going to protect the privacy of students as you continue to collect their data, even incidentally? Did you see how I use like the zeitgeist jargon there? What is the incidental collection potential of tech in the classroom? And then a little bit about where Microsoft is headed broadly.
One of the things that comes up with technology in schools is privacy and data mining. How will these tools and how will you, you know, are you committed to protecting kids' privacy as this technology comes into the classroom?
Right. I mean, as a parent, I care deeply about this. I think that keeping our children safe and students and their data is a huge priority. And so first and foremost, all of the controls on what is being collected and what's being used is all being determined by the student, their family, and the administrators and the teachers. So that is at the core of how we approach privacy. And second is we've made the principal decision that there is no data that we collect and use for advertising or other means. And so therefore, being principled in what we do, and more importantly, providing all of the controls to the student family and the teachers and the administrators is how we're approaching it.
Do you think it's somewhat inevitable, though, as tech comes into the classroom in all its different forms, as kids are online, as those behaviors are inevitably tracked, that we're still opening a little bit of a Pandora's box?
I mean, I think overall privacy and security is sort of going to be core to how computing, I think, gets used going forward. I think that if we do not build trust in technology, it'll impede the speed with which technology will get adopted, because I think that they will not use it. But I think you're absolutely right in saying in education, especially where in the case of education, where you're giving away a free service like Office 365, you cannot have any two sides to it. There has to be clear that the data there is the student's data, it's the school's data, and then you have very principled stance around how you use that data.
How big of an expansion is this for you?
The reason why this is a pretty big move for us is we never brought the comprehensiveness of what Microsoft can and should offer, from Minecraft to even the work we're doing in virtual reality to Windows devices in Office. So that ability for us now to bring all of these things together, that's, I think, what makes it. When you can show that, wow, here is how Minecraft can introduce boys and girls to STEM, or here is how writing in OneNote can enhance learning. Those are the things. The comprehensiveness, perhaps, is what's very new and very needed.
Well, that's kind of your thing, isn't it? Is bringing all of the... My sense is that your thing here at Microsoft is bringing all of the disparate chunks of this company together to operate holistically. Is that a fair statement?
It is a fair statement, because at some level, I've always felt that, you know, no customer or no competition respects our own internal org boundaries, because those are the least important and interesting things for them. And so the ability to be able to relate things together as it makes sense, not just because they're interesting for us to do, some of the best work that's happening in the company is getting channeled into education, and that's fantastic to see.
Does it also give you an opportunity to engender love early on? I mean, I think, you know, one of the things that people would say about Microsoft is it seems like it's running better than it's ever run, but there's less awareness, mm-hmm. Maybe than ever, weirdly. Does it give you a chance to sort of make a kid love you in kindergarten? You know, because Minecraft, I mean, it's the Holy Grail, let's be honest.
Yeah, I mean, that is right. I mean, but in Minecraft, if you look at it, the subtlety about that brand is most people love Minecraft because what they did in Minecraft. That, to me, is what I want. I mean, I actually don't obsess about Microsoft being known as long as what people are doing with Microsoft technology is known. That's sort of at least how I think about our identity. Because we'll never be the company that is just about our brand.
Let's talk broadly about Microsoft for a second. Obviously, a significant change in the administration. Anytime there's a major turnover like this, it's a big deal. How do you see your ability to accomplish your goals as a company evolving under this administration?
We are obviously in touch with the administration on a variety of different fronts, and we welcome their initiatives around infrastructure and modernizing the government. And we definitely have a point of view on how we can help. And we look forward to engaging because I think that's significant. It's not just about infrastructure in the physical sense. The digital infrastructure, I think, can be a significant part. Recently, I was talking to the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, and he just launched a new website in which we played a role, which, you know, is tremendous. It's one of the challenging places where I think digital technology can make a real difference, and we're looking forward to more of those opportunities.
And then how about workforce? I saw that there was a job posting. There was ever so briefly a job posting for a director of immigration policy. How are you looking at hiring? The H-1B visa program is under review.
Yeah, I mean, overall, first of all, I'm a product of two things that I think are great about the United States. One is American technology reaching me where I was growing up and to be able to dream the American dream, and then the enlightened American immigration policy letting me live that dream. And I think the H-1B review is something that I think is a good thing because every country should look at their immigration policy. And especially in this case, it's about American competitiveness. Ultimately, it's about high-skilled labor. A review that says there is the right use of it and there's misuses of it, and we promote more of the right uses of it, all the better for American competitiveness. And at least at Microsoft, when we think about H-1B, it's mostly about high-skilled labor that allows us as an American company to be globally competitive.
Do you think you're going to make any more phones? Total right turn there, I know.
We make phones today. We have OEMs like HP making phones and others. And we've picked a very specific area to focus on, which is management security and this one particular feature that we have called Continuum, which is it's a phone that can even be a desktop. And at this point, we're making sure that all of our software is available on iOS and Android and it's first class. And we're looking for what's the next change in form and function. What we have done with Surface is a good example. No one before us sort of thought of two-in-ones. Mm-hmm. And we created that category and made it a successful category to a point where there are more two-in-ones coming. And that's what we want to do. So in some sense, when you say, will we make more phones? I'm sure we'll make more phones, but they may not look like phones that are there today.
Right. Maybe you'll make the thing that... I just read this sci-fi book, actually, that talked about a technology that was... It was light field technology, like narrow band light field, that would just target your iris. And it, you know, talked about how the entire consumer electronics or industry fell apart as a result. So you're totally working on that.
Right? And HoloLens is the closest thing that we have to that.
I knew it.
I couldn't... I mean...
Yeah.
I'm a nerd.
No, that's all right. You got to go where you got to go, man. I get it. It's all good. HoloLens and iris scanning and the CEO of Microsoft, Satya Nadella, talking to Molly Wood.
We also had the one more question, obviously,
yes,
for Satya Nadella, our Make Me Smart question, the one that we ask everyone we talk to. What is something you thought you knew, but you later found out you were wrong about? And here's his answer.
I thought that... it would be great to record everything and not have to actually write down anything. And as I was reading about, because I used to question, is inking important anymore? Because I've said, well, if everything can be indexed and recalled as just voice or images, why would anyone write anymore? And it turns out I was totally wrong, because our human brain has evolved in such a way that if we don't write, we don't retain. And so that's at least what I've learned recently, and not at least I've gotten reinforced recently.
All right, yeah, so two things. One is I'm totally a learner by writing. If I don't write it down, I got nothing. But also, inking, that was an interesting little bit of jargon he just threw in right there. I've never heard that.
I know, inking.
Yeah.
It's like I had never heard that either, and apparently it is what happens when you use a stylus, which you were doing. Kai, you're an inker.
Well, those who didn't see that particular Facebook Live, I now use my tablet and I write on that instead of killing trees and using yellow pads. But yeah, I guess this is inking because it's, I don't know.
Does it help as much, do you find?
Too early.
Writing on the tablet?
Still too early. Still too early. And I've got this tactile thing. There's something wrong with the interface between the point of the stylus and the smooth glass surface that doesn't have the friction. So I need somebody out there to invent a frictioned stylus that will work on a glass tablet.
Yeah, I'm torn too. I recently bought a paper planner. I mean, I'm picking up what Satya's laying down, but it's interesting because in a tiny, tiny way, it almost argues against everything that he just said about technology in the schools. Maybe what they really need is pencils.
Maybe. But that would be leading. Anyway, we will be back in a minute with an update on the Make Me Smart Book Club. All right, so is that a plain old guitar or was that a ukulele? That was just a plain old guitar. All right, I don't know why I said guitar.
How to start a book club.
Books are fun.
I have my own book club.
Oh, I just can't wait to read a book.
We asked you to vote on which book you ought to read for our Make Me Smart book club. There are five choices. You can read all about them at marketplace.org/makemesmart.
Yep, and we are going to give you one more week to vote, but I will say that right now the two books in the lead are The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion by Jonathan Haidt, which at least seven friends have recently recommended to me, in addition to all of you. And then in the number two or tied spot is The Man in the High Castle by Philip K. Dick. Make your opinion heard. One more week to vote for your choice at bit.ly/MMS. That's short for Make Me Smart. MMS Books. bit.ly/MMS Books.
No pressure here, but vote for Man in the High Castle because I want to get away from religion and politics and all that jazz. I just want a good, like, fantasy thing. We will announce final book club choice May 9th on the episode, and then we'll all read it and we'll talk about it.
You can't tell them what to vote for.
It's
now
America.
They're going to.
I can do whatever I want.
Oh, for Pete's sake. Vote for Calvin and Hobbes. Now, now as always, though.
That's best comic strip ever, but that's a whole different episode.
I just want to read Calvin and Hobbes, you guys. Now, as always, though, my favorite part of the show. You sent us some mail.
Where do we mail a letter?
So we were talking last week about government and whether it ought to be run as a business. It was part of our Edison Research Marketplace National Economic Survey that we did. And we had some people on the show who thought it was a decent idea. And we got this great voicemail from Eric Sinio. He is a park ranger in the U.S. National Park Service. Here you go.
Hey, Kai and Molly. I really love the show, but I have to question whether or not government being run like a business is ever a good idea. If a business's goal is to produce profits and to respond to its shareholders, I'd like to get back to that question that was asked in the early days of the show. If we as citizens are the shareholders of the government, should we somehow expect a profit back from the government? And if that's the case, does any government endeavor that doesn't bring back money, is that something that should be cut? What about larger societal goals? What about education? Or, in my own personal experience as a park ranger for the National Park Service, does it work to have a park that allows people to get in for relatively cheaply? For most national parks, if they are bringing in a single dollar of federal money, they're producing $11 in economic benefit in the surrounding territories, the surrounding communities, the surrounding businesses. Why would any federal government allow those dollars to slip through their fingers? And instead, why wouldn't they charge 11 or 12 or 20 times as much to go into a national park instead? And who's going to go to Grand Canyon if it costs you $250 to get through the door? Thanks again for bringing it up. Thanks for getting me thinking. And thanks for making us all smarter.
Yeah, all really good points, right? It's public good versus the private goods that a corporation is invested in. Totally fascinating topic about which we could go on all day, but we won't.
Yeah, people really did, too. We got a lot of tweets and emails about it. And I would say the majority, I was surprised that the majority said absolutely not. That makes no sense. It tells you the sentiment around business in some ways that people were so vehement in believing that government should absolutely not be run like a business. All right. We also have a correction because I got almost as many emails and tweets to make sure that we knew that it was Tammy Baldwin, the Democratic senator from Wisconsin, who had sponsored a Buy America bill that required the government to use U.S. steel in infrastructure projects. I said it was Tammy Duckworth. It was Baldwin. And thank you. Thanks for the quick heads up, by the way, because apparently you guys literally download the show and listen to it immediately, which is fantastic because it let us make a quick fix and put out last week's show all over again. We also made our producer run five laps around the building.
Yeah.
She wrote that. She put that in there.
That's her. We didn't actually do
that. No, come on. It happened. But thank you for helping us out because I actually really appreciate it.
And part of the way we got all that feedback, by the way, was on Twitter, @KaiRizdahl is me, @MollyWood is her. which is a very awkward segue into this. The trip we took to Chicago, was it this week? I can't even remember, or last week. It was last week.
Making right? the sausage.
All right. Last
week. It was last yes. week. It was one of the cities.
Yes.
Yep.
And why, pray tell, were we in Chicago?
We were there. We showed up bright and early to City Hall to pay our tickets. No, to interview. turns out, both Kai and I have racked up quite a parking bill. Yes. We showed up at City Hall to interview the mayor of Chicago, one Rahm Emanuel, a name you're probably familiar with. We talked to him for quite a long time, like way longer than I thought he would have made for us, about sanctuary cities, what he is doing to help Chicago's economic outlook, and apparently why Mr. Kai Ryssdal would make a really good Jewish grandmother. Mm-hmm. Here is just a hint. You guys, it was good. Yeah. Here's just a hint of what's coming your way next week.
First of all, this is your first time meeting me.
That is correct.
All you know is what you've read. And you don't...
And seen.
Okay. But you don't know me. And just because other journalists write about stereotypes doesn't mean that's not who the whole person is.
It was really an interesting chat. He got a little cranky with me. I got a little cranky with him. You know, it was interesting, I thought, anyway.
I played Peacemaker.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it was good.
It was like a hockey game. And then I get... No, it was wonderful. And it really, you know, it's a passionate guy.
Totally. Totally. All right. That's it. We got to go. Vote in the book club poll, please. Just make sure you vote the right way. Review us on what's it called now? Apple Podcasts. Subscribe. All those good things. Let me say that again. Subscribe, subscribe, subscribe. Algorithms make that more valuable. I don't know. Whatever.
just
do it, please.
The wonderful Make Me Smart is produced by the wonderful Jenny Josephson, Bridget Bodner, and senior producer Nancy Fregali. This week's program was engineered by Mr. Bill Lance. Our theme music is composed in the house by Ben Holiday and Daniel Ramirez.
The executive producer of Marketplace is Sitar Nieves. Senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark.
Here comes my favorite part.
Yeah, what is it? Oh, that little thing right there?
Yes! A key change! I love a key change!
Wow.
I'm dancing, you guys. I'm dancing.
No dancing on the radio? What?
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.